parenting is all about raising my children, raising them to be people that love the Lord, that want to pursue what's good. But many, many times they don't do that. And when there's a problem in the family, what I want to do out of my own fear is to make them the problem. Rather than doing that, I need to look at myself and see where I need to grow up.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband, Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
One of my sons has a friend that is eternally grounded. This is one of my son's favorite friends, and he'll call him, and most of the time, this kid is grounded. I was standing by the phone with my son when he called this other boy this weekend, and the first question he said, Jack, was, "Are you grounded?" It really is quite tragic to me. I feel very, very bad for this boy. He is acting out. He is kind of doing some things wrong. But I think a lot of what's going on in that family is that the parents are doing a whole lot wrong. I see this boy is getting more and more discouraged because, in part, he tries to do it well, and his parents come down on him and down on him and down on him. They're very, very tight. And what I'd love to do is go to those parents and say, "Back off. Let me talk to you for a few minutes." And that's what I'd like to talk about today in our show is, how do we as parents deal with our parenting? Not look at the kid and what they're doing wrong as much today as what might we need to look at as parents? What are we doing well and what are we not doing well?
What you're suggesting is that the way that we relate to our children in our parenting is often more about what we're afraid of, what we're not trusting in, what we are not... where we don't have freedom within ourselves, and out of our panic and our fear, we do things that are not particularly helpful to our children.
That's great, Jack. That's the bottom line, but I think you got there too fast.
Okay.
So let's go back and talk about that some. We've talked about this in our other programs, and this is a recurring theme, but we haven't quite approached it in this way. So what might our fears be? What might our concerns be that we're not looking at and instead kind of scapegoating our children is really what you're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly it. Unfortunately, lots of times things aren't going well in our own lives or in our lives as a couple with our spouse. And we can triangulate or scapegoat the child. Or they're not going well inside of me, or I have concerns inside of me, and I scapegoat the child to make myself more comfortable. I'm trying to think of four examples. You got one?
Well, not of those last two that you just mentioned, but I can think of an example. We have a child who has a learning disability, and particularly early on in elementary school, we just didn't know how to handle it. And what I mean by that is we didn't know how to help him. He had a real difficulty learning to read, and nothing that we tried seemed to make any difference. We took him for physical exams, we took him for all kinds of testing, just we did everything that we could do. And my wife was affected by this more than I was, and I remember her talking to me once about how frustrated she would get with this child, but that the reason she was so frustrated is because she was scared for him.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, probably an exaggerated fear, but on the other hand, a very understandable fear, that she was just afraid that he would not be able to handle academics in school at all, that he would fail, and that that failure would translate into other failures in his life, and that here we were helpless to do anything to prevent him from this inevitable failure that she feared. And just as we often do in so many situations, when we are afraid for someone, we often don't treat them very well, because
we want to change them so that we're more comfortable.
Right. And so, you know, basically you just picture yourself grabbing them by the scruff of the collar and shaking them and saying, change. Don't let this problem in my life. Don't let this... You are the source of fear. And whenever someone is the source of fear, we at times don't like them. Not because we don't like them, but we don't like the fear that they are the source of.
So then it kind of exacerbates the problem, because then they become the person we don't like and they feel unliked.
Right. Right.
And we're increasing the problem then. And that's what we're meaning by scapegoating. We're making the child the problem rather than looking at my fear as the problem. I think that's just an excellent example, Jack, that very often we don't look at our fear as the problem, but we look at the child as the problem. And I think that's the number one thing we as parents really, really need to look at. Myself, primarily, before I look at how the child needs to be changed. What am I doing in this system that's creating positive, and what am I doing in this system that's creating negative results? And very often we just want to look at the child and blame it on them. If they would only try harder, perhaps in this circumstance you could say. Perhaps if my child would only behave more, perhaps if my child would only do this or that, then everything would be better. And I think when we start thinking that way, we really need to look at ourselves. What can I do to change the situation?
And or even in our case, how can we dissolve or...
How can I confront my fear?
Or de-exaggerate the fear, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what my wife and I did, and I don't want to imply that we did this successfully all the time, but what we attempted to do is remind ourselves... I mean, the question that I posed one time was, what's the worst that can happen? And when we realized the worst that can happen is that he wouldn't be a wealthy businessman, but just getting by in life economically, wow, okay. That's not really all that bad. And we somehow, especially parents, have a way of you know, we want the best for our children, and so anything less than the best seems like some kind of failure or seems like some kind of tragedy. And when we could get some objectivity and some perspective on it and realize the worst that can happen is X, and looked at it and thought X wasn't really all that bad, then we can kind of relax with it and go, okay, well then whatever happens is going to happen here. We just need to day by day be kind and loving and supportive.
And remind ourselves of this all the time.
Yeah, and that's what we weren't always successful at doing.
You weren't?
No.
I thought you were like an always successful dad, Jack.
Well, I like to think that, yeah.
That's a big lie. I mentioned, I think, last program that I really struggle with. My kids sometimes not fitting in, and out of my own fear, I try to kind of manipulate their lives, or... Actually, I kind of get too invasive. Yesterday, I was talking to my daughter. She just bought a new dress, and she came home, and she said, but when I go around, I want to wear this to school tomorrow, Mom. But then I couldn't go on the bars, and because you could see my underwear when I went over. And I said, well, you know, just wear a pair of shorts. And then I started thinking. I had this awful thought, bars. Oh, my gosh. I used to spend my whole elementary school on the bars. And the reason that I spent it on the bars was because I didn't have any friends. And so I just acted like I was really interested in being kind of an acrobat on those bars. And I turned to my daughter and I said, so you're on the bars because you have no friends, right? And she said, yes. That killed me. I could go through all sorts of really unhelpful things, because it is so painful for me to see her not having friends. I just could die over that. And what I have to remind myself of is this may be the way in which God is going to mature my daughter. This may be God's biggest tool in her young life. She's got so much else that she could not go through the kind of suffering that it takes to really understand life, to gain wisdom, to see things from a perspective that's most valuable. And so that's kind of how I, in part, have soothed myself, is, okay, God, even if this is a really hard thing, then that's okay, because if she learns about you through this, then that's better. And secondly, I guess I have a lot more to learn here too. So I have to learn to back off and to enter into the suffering rather than try to manipulate the situation so that I don't feel so absolutely, tragically sad. It's very sad for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell her then about your experience? Was that part of how you interacted with that?
I did.
Yeah.
After that I said, you know, I kind of got choked up, of course, which is easy for me. But I said, you know, she goes, how did you know? And I said, because when I was a little girl, that's what I did too. That's exactly what I did. And I hugged her and I said, I feel just really sad for that. And she cried with me for a few minutes. It was a touching thing, but it isn't for me to ask her to heal my pain, which is obviously still there, but to feel with her is a very appropriate and helpful thing. It normalizes it for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that can, I mean, just for everybody, adults and children, oftentimes when we know that what we're going through is not unique to us, it, when other people share that same burden or have passed through those same waters, it's very comforting in a weird sort of way.
You know, I really agree. I just think that it's something that I try to do a lot with my children, to show them my struggles. I think it would have been so helpful for me to have gotten that when I was growing up, but I always felt so different, odd, weird, very much of an outcast, because I thought other people really didn't feel this way. In fact, I wrote a letter, radio letter, I don't know, several months ago now, I guess, but I said a liberation began for me when I entered into a college course. It was a group psychology course, and that's the purpose, really, of groups, or one of the main purposes, is to see that our issues are universal. And I saw that, and it just floored me. It was so comforting to me. It's probably why I ended up being a counselor, because I wanted to be able to help people have that kind of freedom also.
Mm-hmm. Well, backing up a little bit, Christine, in order to have the freedom to interact with your daughter the way that you did, we've talked about this before, but it involves, it's somehow being, I think the way you put it, is it involves being okay that your child is suffering here. And that's what's so hard for us as parents, is that, I think the way I put it in the past, it goes against all of our parental instincts to let our children suffer at all. We just don't want them to experience any pain. And something about being a parent, it feels like it's our job to protect them from pain. So when we're in a situation where they're suffering and there's really nothing we can do about it, that in turn is a source of suffering and pain for us. And being okay with a life that involves that kind of suffering is a really, really crucial component to being the kind of parent who can not get impatient, not get scared, not get exasperated, not get controlling and manipulative, is when we're willing to allow a little pain in our children's life and therefore into our own life.
Or I'd like to edit that a little bit, not get impatient or not. What were all the things you said? Or maybe when we get all those things, then we can work with them. Because we are going to become impatient.
Right, sure, yeah.
We are going to get scared. We are going to lack faith. And then when we see that in ourselves, what do we do? Do I then use that as a signal to try and change my children, or do I use that as a good piece of information for me to do some more work that I really need to be doing?
Yeah, I mean, it ultimately comes back to, do we or do we not trust God, the author of my being, and God, the author of my children's being? Do I or don't I trust him? Does he know what he's doing? Does he not know what he's doing? And that's, I think, how you handled it with respect to your daughter, that you realize there's someone bigger than me who actually is more concerned and more involved in my daughter's life even than I am. It's her creator. And his agenda is to teach her wisdom. And if this is the way he's going to teach her wisdom, just as it was in your case, then so be it. I mean, I say that like that's easy to say. It's not easy to say, but I think that's ultimately how we, that's how we have to come to terms with many of those fears.
And Jack, even as we're talking about it now, my daughter is at school. It's probably about recess time. And you know what's going on in my stomach? It's churning. Because I'm anxious about it. So I guess the question comes down, do I trust God with this? Well, I'm working to, I want to, but ultimately I don't very much. And that's what happens in my life a whole lot of the time. And that's what I think on how merciful God is to me, because I'm not a very trusting person. I want to be, but he's merciful to me in the midst of my stomach doing turns right now.
This is sort of a tangent, but...
We always do tangents.
I think it's important to recognize that a stomach churning and trusting God are not necessarily incompatible.
Are you going to tell me I'm wrong?
Well, what we would prefer is for my trust in God to be able to, you know, bring tranquility to my life. But I think that's, I mean, that just isn't the way it works oftentimes. There's a false view of the gospel, a false view of Christianity that says, come to God and he will protect you from all harm. Biblical Christianity says, come to God because God is there, he's the author of reality, and he ultimately has a blessing in store for you that's worth having. You would be crazy not to come to God. I mean, that's what biblical Christianity says. But it doesn't have anything, a part of it, that says, and in the meantime, he's going to protect you from all harm. There's no promise like that. I think you know that. That's why your stomach churns, because you realize that God, in his wisdom, in his sovereignty, may have your daughter go through painful times socially. I mean, if you could believe that God is going to solve the problem and she's going to come home with a ton of friends, your stomach wouldn't be churning. But you know that that's not necessarily there. You know that that's not necessarily a promise. And you have to realize the realistic possibility that there's going to be a great deal of emotional pain in your daughter's life. That's just one example among many that we could give. But the classic paradigm for me is Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Clearly, from his words, he trusted his father implicitly, and he was stressed to the max. I mean, that was the most stressful experience described in Jesus' life. It was as stressful as any experience you and I will ever have.
Yeah, so but I get to have a churning stomach, huh?
Exactly.
I like that. Yeah, that's such a great example. When you said it, I just went, oh, yeah, my shoulders kind of went down and I started breathing a little bit better. Because he did. He stressed a lot. And it really didn't have to do with trusting God. It had to do with hurting, because he was going to go into a hurting situation.
Mm-hmm. And he knew that his father would not spare him from that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it was stressful.
Mm-hmm.
But he was willing to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as stressful and as unpleasant as it was, he was willing to go there. That's faith. That's what we need to do with respect to ourselves and with respect to our children. There are going to be some really emotionally painful times ahead. Am I willing to go there?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm willing to go there, then I'm also willing to consider doing the right thing when I'm there. It's when I'm not willing to go there that I manipulate and I coerce and
exactly.
I try to do everything I can to avoid it.
And that is really a lack of trust, more
right.
than the pain that I experience. But many times, Jack, it comes down to, am I willing to do what's right, as in perhaps not controlling the other person, not keeping my own equilibrium by changing what they do? Am I willing, or am I going to embrace the suffering on the other side? And it really doesn't look like a very good choice to me to go ahead and embrace the suffering. But it's a huge opportunity for me to grow up, and we've said this in other programs. I think we agreed that one of the biggest reasons for children in our lives, one of the plans for them, is to help us grow up.
Mm-hmm.
We look at it, coming back to the intent of the show today, we look at it so much as our job is to get the kids to grow up. And absolutely, that's our job as parents. It's also our job as parents to grow up
Good
through
point.
Our children.
Excellent. Yeah, exactly.
So I want to go back to something that I said, just kind of in passing really quickly. I said that one of the ways that we keep, one of the reasons that we try and change our children, or we try and manipulate them, or try and get them to do something, is out of our own fear. Another one, and we talked about that just a little bit, gave a couple of examples. And, I would at this point like to ask the listeners to ask us some questions about this if you have them, because I think it's such an important point where it might be Greek to some people. So if you don't get it, guys, write us a letter and let us address this some more. It's very, very pivotal in our parenting. But the second thing I said, one of the things that we do, we scapegoat our children because we may, as a couple, be having problems in our marriage. And instead of looking at the problems between ourselves in our marriage, very often we scapegoat the children. We can scapegoat them either by giving them too much and just kind of immersing them in stuff or spoiling them in some way. So all our focus becomes them, as though we're incredibly loving parents. But we're not focused on each other as marriage partners. We're only focused on the children. Another possible problem could be the static between us is so big, we don't want to experience that, so we triangulate another child. We make them the problem.
Okay, I wonder if you could flesh that out, because I can't, I'm sure that's true. I don't have a lot of experience with that, and I can't relate to that as well. Why would you pick a child to, are we blaming the child?
Yeah.
So we're shifting the blame on the child.
We're shifting the blame.
And why would we do that? What's the, I mean, is it just purely irrational, or is there...
I don't think it's something that most parents do, decide, okay, we can't really deal with each other, the conflict is too big between us, so we'll deal with the child, or we'll make the child the problem. But I remember a counseling class way, way back, 20 years ago, and it was before I was a parent, and what they did is they had this family come in, and I watched the counselor. The parents were scapegoating this child, blaming the child, looking at the child exclusively, and the kid was really acting out. So what the counselor did was take the child and put him in a different part of the room, kind of off. So the two parents were on one side, the counselor was kind of in the middle, and the child was off. Then the counselor started to deal with the two parents, and it became obvious that the conflict between the two parents was raging and yet had not been addressed at all. And the child then, over a period of time with this family, the child ended up being released from the grips that the parents needed so that they wouldn't have to look at themselves. As the counselor got them to deal with their problems between each other, the child was freed up. I think that was about as clear as fog, wasn't it?
Well, I think I understood what you said. I'm just trying to put myself in that position, trying to understand under what circumstances would I blame a child for what the problems I have with my wife. I mean, why would I do that?
I haven't been clear.
Okay.
I don't blame the child for the problems I have with my wife. I'm not addressing the problems with my wife
or
my husband. And there's a lot of energy there between us. We've got to do something with it.
Okay, so I'm just angry, probably.
I'm just angry, or I'm frustrated, or I don't have a sense of adequacy in knowing how to deal with this relationship.
Right.
So the focus becomes the child. It's a very easy road there.
Because the child is manageable. I can intimidate the child. I can't do that in the problems in my relationship. this is a more vulnerable person, so I can.
I think that's the bottom line.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not just that I might intimidate the child, but I also might just overindulge the child because I really maybe don't have a relationship with my spouse that I feel comfortable with, and maybe I don't feel comfortable with intimacy, but I do feel comfortable with this child.
Mm-hmm.
So I will perhaps even parentify the child so that they become kind of a partner with me. That then creates another problem. I'm in alliance with my child. That puts my husband or my wife out. Husband or wife gets jealous, and that goes back to the child, angry perhaps at the child for the role they're playing.
Okay.
So that can be a very, very difficult scenario for a child, and the child looks like the problem. Boy, kids really get caught in the middle. And again, I really believe as parents, this happens a lot. And we need to keep our eyes open to it. We need to ask ourselves the question, does this have something to do with the way I'm relating to the child? Could it have to do with something that I'm not doing or doing with my spouse that could be hurtful? Whenever I'm blaming someone or scapegoating them, I always need to see that as a red flag to look back at myself.
What you find in the Old Testament prophets is a theme that keeps coming up over and over and over again. My brother has been teaching through the book of Isaiah recently, and he pointed this out in Isaiah, that the spiritual health of a culture or a civilization can be measured by the way it treats the most disadvantaged, the weakest, the most vulnerable members of the society. And one of the things that came to mind is children. You know, how we relate to our children is a reflection of the spiritual health, not only of the culture, but
of me.
And, I mean, that's the thing that, if there's any question about the depravity of the human heart, just think about the things that I do with respect to my children, how willing I am to make them disposable. And yet the most natural thing in the world is to protect them, to keep them safe, to nurture them, to keep them healthy. I mean, there's all kinds of instincts toward that. And yet my own self-centeredness can even overcome those instincts to turn them into, as you put it, a scapegoat or an escape, or I objectify them and just use them for my own selfish, self-centered purposes.
And it's quite a paradox, Jack, because on one hand, I might be a mother bear for my children. If you're going to come up and you're going to hurt my kid, man, you are the problem, Jack. I'm going to really protect them. But if they don't clean their rooms and they haven't done what I asked them to do 20 times that day, man, they become the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we do both things. We have this instinct to protect
right.
them. I think we don't have an instinct to protect them from ourselves
right.
is the biggest thing, because I think my own selfishness very often trumps.
Sure.
And that's a very okay. incredibly unfortunate thing.
And that's a comment on the depravity of us as human beings generally.
It is.
Yeah.
I'd like to make one final comment on this, at least one more, is that very often, parents will bring a child in and kind of dump them in a counselor or psychologist's office and say, fix my child. And I have a very strong bias against that. If a child is having a problem, they're having a problem in the context of their family. It could have to do with their biology also. It could have to do with the environment around them other than their family also. But certainly the family has a very big part in the development of a child's character and their psyche. So if parents can come in, and to the extent that they have responsibility, that they come into the counselor and say, look, we want to learn to be better parents. This is the situation in our home. So they go to the counselor, they get help, and then they bring their changes into their relationship with their family as a whole. Then the child doesn't become the scapegoat. He doesn't become the identified patient. Once a child becomes an identified patient, they become the person who sees themselves as the problem in the family. And, of course, what we're doing is we're asking for even more problems, because the child, then says, okay, I am the problem, and my parents have it right. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to do as parents is not make the child, I keep saying this over and over, not make the child the problem. How can we as parents improve what we are doing?
Make sure we communicate to them that we recognize that they are not the problem.
Absolutely, and that's one big way. Don't send them in for help. Send me in for help.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I'm working with parents in regard to their children, and I don't do lots of family therapy or therapy with children, but I will sometimes want the child to come in and experience who the child is in the room. And I'll tell the parents, what I want you to do is tell your child that I need some information to him, from him about the family and about you, so that I can help you to be better parents. Sometimes when a child becomes like an adolescent, it's very helpful to have all of them in, at least for some time, so I can get some information from the child. So I'm not always excluding the child, but certainly my main emphasis is to have the parents take responsibility as much as they can for what's going on. I don't want to blame them and say, or shame them and say, you know, you're just being bad parents and how could you do that? But given that we all struggle with parenting, what is it that I could do as a parent that will make it better? And often I'm very blind to that. Very often I've found with parents, we're trying to not do it the way our parents did it. But in our efforts to not do it that way, we often kind of swing the pendulum and go in the other direction, doing something perhaps just as wrong, for example, but just in the other direction. For example, instead of be an intimidating parent, I might be an overly indulgent parent, so that my child doesn't have boundaries, perhaps, where I had too many. And so we tend to make these swings and then be blind to them, not see them. Mm. And very often we need outside help for that, or at least not necessarily a counselor, but I think we need to have some accountability, maybe with friends who will tell us the truth and say, you know, there's a problem here. What is it that you see me doing that I could change?
Hmm. I'm sure we've said this before, but it bears saying again that, well, actually, I was talking to a friend of mine last night, in fact, and he was asking me about the program and what we're talking about and what sorts of points are we going over. And he made the comment, sounds like what you're saying is you have to be sanctified to be a good parent. And I paused and realized, yes, that ultimately that is what we're saying. Because, and this, the point that you just made bears this out, I'm not going to be prepared to really, truly, profoundly, in a meaningful way, admit that I am part of the problem in my relationship with my child and in the dynamic of the family, unless I'm prepared to admit that I am fallible, that I am sinful, that I am evil, that I am selfish, that all those things that the Bible says is true about me is indeed and in fact true about me. If I don't own that truth about myself, it's going to be very difficult to have the sort of profound freedom to say to my child, you know, I really messed up here. I'm the problem here. I really shouldn't interact in this way, and here's what's going on, and it's wrong, it's selfish, it's inappropriate for me to act in that way. You're just going to have to forgive me. I mean, how can I really say that with any kind of depth and profundity unless I believe it? And as we've said in past programs, it's something that we don't really believe easily. We might give lip service to it for one reason or another because somebody told us to do that as a strategy or something, but that's not lost on children. They know when we're authentic and when we're not. So ultimately, it kind of comes back to what you were saying earlier. Ultimately, learning to be a good parent is learning to be sanctified. Growing in parenting is growing as a person. Growing in parenting is growing up into the righteous person that God wants me to be. And if we refuse to do that, if we refuse to grow as people, then I really think the idea of becoming good parents is hopeless.
It is. It's absolutely hopeless. It kind of feels hopeless anyway sometimes.
Yeah,
because
that's
true. I really struggle with my own growth. It's a very hard thing, and I think children bring out the very most true about us, and it's very humbling mm-hmm. to experience that all the time. You were saying that, or we're talking about the willingness to admit that we blew it. That is so profoundly important and so profoundly difficult to know that we blew it. And I was just, when you were talking, I was just thinking of this gift that my daughter gave me. It reminds me of what we're talking about. On Mother's Day, she gave me kind of a little stack of papers that said, you know, this is good for one back scratch, this is good for one breakfast in bed, this is good for one head scratch. You know, she went through all these things that she knows I like. And then at the very last one, she said, and this is, I wish I could remember exactly how it reads, but this is for a forgiving daughter throughout your lifetime. That was incredible. She knew that she would have to be a person that forgave me, which obviously says I'm a person that's going to need forgiveness throughout my life. And it was just so beautiful. One, that she knew I would blow it, but that she could talk about that with me. That's so great. That's so beautiful. I just felt like, yes, we're getting somewhere. But on the other hand, it's very humbling.
Yeah.
Very humbling.
Yeah, there's that thing that rises up in you and says,
wait a minute.
Forgive me. What do you vote?
What do you mean you're going to have to forgive me throughout your life? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's something I probably need to frame. It's a very beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I think that both as parents of young children and parents of adult children, we need to continue this. A willingness to admit where we're wrong or admit where we've been wrong, admit where we blew it. Let's talk first, if I can, a little bit more about what do I do when I blew it with my young child. One of the things you said just now, I don't think you meant to put it exactly this way, but you said my child is just going to have to forgive me. Well, my child may not forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a hard thing. And I don't think you intended to try. And that's another thing we can't manipulate or control.
Right, that's their choice.
Yeah, I would want them to forgive me. And that's why my daughter's note was so incredibly endearing to me. I hope she wants to. I remember when one of my sons was like 12, he was just about to turn 13. Okay, Jesse, will you still love me when you're a teenager? And he said, oh, yeah, Mom, I will always love you. Well, I don't know if my son loved me too much. He's now 18, but there were a few years in there where he just didn't care that much for me at all. And you know, my son chose for about 2 years not to forgive me. He ended up getting into a situation where we thought he had done something really wrong. And he, about a year ago, he's now 18, so he was about 16 or 17, and it was kind of like a truth time for our family. And he said that we're sitting around, we're talking about these things, and he said that he had not been forgiving of me for 2 years, and his attitude had really changed toward me. And I said, you know, incredulous, you know, why? Why is that? And he said, because about that time, you said that you had smoked pot when you were a teenager, and he has, for whatever reason, I don't know how he got there, but he put people who smoke pot in with, like, prostitutes. And he really lost his respect for me at that point. He thought I was this great mom who would do things really well. Don't know where he got that idea. Because I do things so wrong so much and tell them. But anyway, it was like the worst thing. And he lost his respect for me. And for 2 years, he was very unforgiving to me. He was really on my case a lot, and I didn't have a clue. I just thought maybe he was growing up being a teenager, and it was very difficult for me to not coerce some kind of forgiveness. He could act nice, but I knew that there was something else underneath. It wasn't that he was openly disrespectful, but I knew he had a hard heart toward me. And it just killed me. And this is a situation where I couldn't get him to forgive me. I had to live with what was. And going back to what we said earlier, just allow myself to live with the suffering of having a child that obviously had a hard heart toward me. I think it's really great if we have kids that are willing to forgive us, but that may not be the case. And it's something that you said a couple of weeks ago. We don't have no guarantee that if we embrace values like forgiveness, that we want to pursue God, that our kids are guaranteed to want that also.
Right.
They may not necessarily, or they may not necessarily now, they might not till they're 40 or 50 or 90, want to embrace some of the values that we think are very important, or they may not ever.
Take something like forgiveness and mercy. There's a really strong connection between my willingness to extend mercy to others and my recognition that I need mercy myself. And it's not unusual for an adolescent or a young adult to be incredibly self-righteous. They haven't lived long enough yet to recognize how fallible they are, how selfish they are, how cruel they are. When they come to see how easy it is to be bad, then they can forgive the bad in me.
Right.
A lot more easily. Not necessarily, but a lot more easily. And so there can be a time lag between when they've decided that I'm just a jerk or a creep or a lousy parent, and the time that they come to realize I can't hold that against them because I'm no better.
Mm-hmm.
That they won't immediately understand that.
Now, I'd like to make a little comment here with that. I absolutely agree with you. They need to see that they're the same as me eventually, but it doesn't take away the fact that I may have already hurt them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that takes me to, what do we do with our children now after they're out of the house and they're adults and they come to us and they want to talk about their childhood or how they were raised, and what do we do there? Are we parents that say, you know, we just defend ourselves and just say, I did the best I could, and how could you do this? I gave you so much. And I don't think so. I think we need to be parents who are, again, willing to realistically look at our parenting, say where we failed, talk it through with them, because that will give them a foundation to stand on. If we're saying, yeah, I was an A-plus parent, and they're struggling, you know, with their own sin, that's going to really harm them, both spiritually and emotionally. So what we need to do is say, this is realistically what kind of parent I was. Not just say, forgive me, just to kind of push it off, but to be willing to be in a place where we're humbly looking at the situation in order to help our children as best we can. Inherent in that is our desire for forgiveness, but sometimes we can use forgiveness as a way to shut everything up and to not go to places that we need to with our children, to help give them a handle on their life today.
Well, it's important to recognize that the biblical concept of forgiveness is not forget it in the sense of let's not talk about it, let's not look at it, let's ignore it, let's pretend it didn't happen, which is what we sometimes mean by forgive me. What I really mean is let's not go there. Let's not even think about it. And that's not forgiveness, because there's nothing to forgive until you've understood the crime, the evil, the grievance that they have against me. If I don't really understand it, what's being forgiven?
Right.
I think true forgiveness always involves
a full understanding.
We can't always come to a full understanding, I think, of what we have done wrong. Because we're not them. You know, we're not on that end of it. We're on this end of it. But at least we can come to enough of an understanding to realize my sin was at work, my selfishness was at work, and it obviously hurt them very deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And acknowledge that and face into it.
And I think what we want to do is we want it not to have been. We want to be able to change it. And if we can just deny it or minimize it, then it won't hurt me as bad. And there again is our opportunity to grow up. Am I going to embrace the pain of this reality, or am I going to not and hurt my children once again?
Mm-hmm.
Just living with, I have done something wrong, or I have done a lot wrong, is very painful, but it is the most, paradoxically, the most healing thing our children could have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, for example, my husband was going to go away for the weekend, and he said that he would clean the floors, and just a really simple thing, and it was Friday after or Thursday afternoon, and he was going to be leaving Friday morning, and he came. He was in very late from work, and I said, "Gosh, Larry, I really." He hadn't done the floors, and I said, "I really am disappointed that you didn't do the floors." And he started to defend himself, and then he said, "You know, you're right. I didn't get them done." And it was like, it was fine then. You know, he didn't do the floors. He didn't defend himself. He didn't get upset with me. It's just the truth. We both acknowledged that we wanted that done, and that's what's so healing, and that's so hard a concept for us to get, that just going there with somebody is very healing and very supportive and very the best sometimes that we can give, and not just the best we can give, but actually truly very, very good. Sometimes when I'm working with parents, they are recognizing for the first time, maybe they're 50 years old and they have 25-year-old children, and they're realizing for the first time some of the problems that they created with their children. The children aren't coming to them yet. They often ask me, "What should I do? Because I think I've really hurt my children." I think it's great for the parent to go and talk to the child, kind of feel them out first. Is this something the child's going to want? Sometimes children don't want it at all. They want to believe the fantasy that they have in their mindset. Used to agree with the parents. The parents used to think that also. And so I would recommend...
Namely, that they were great parents, you mean?
Yeah, or, yeah. Okay. They had this ideal childhood.
I see.
So when the parent goes back, they can say, you know, if you're ever willing to talk about it, I'm really open to doing that. Sometimes children really embrace it. There are adult children. Sometimes they don't at all. I wouldn't force it, but I'd sure be there with open arms when and if the children ever came back to me. So we've got about 30 seconds here, Jack, and I'd just like to underline what we're saying today. As parents, our responsibility is to raise our children. It's also our responsibility to allow ourselves to be raised by God.
This program is produced by the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. The McKenzie Study Center was established in 1979 as a campus ministry near the University of Oregon. Since its beginning, it has focused its attention on encouraging, assisting, and equipping Christians with the tools to understand the Bible. The Study Center's staff believes that a clear understanding of God's Word is not merely an intellectual exercise, but the truth of the Bible is a radical message that every human being must understand. Central to the ministry is the thorough examination of our deep ingrained brokenness and rebellion against God. Consequently, understanding our desperate need for God's grace and mercy is also important to the Study Center ministry. McKenzie offers classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. The heart of the Study Center teaching ministry is the Tuesday night lectures. One of our classic Tuesday lecture series is Dr. Jack Crabtree's exposition of the Book of Romans. Other topics include marriage and sexuality, biblical interpretation, modern challenges to Christianity, and of course, the radical nature of the gospel. The Study Center also has numerous articles which may help many in their growth as Christians. For example, in her article, Pain and Glory, staff member Nancy Scott reveals her struggles with God when her mother was severely disabled with a major stroke, and what she learned from her mother's suffering, as well as her own. Or the article, In Praise of Manna, in which Dr. Crabtree examines Deuteronomy chapter 8 and the story of the manna in the wilderness, as an illustration of how God uses suffering to humble his servants so they do not live for earthly delights, but rather the promises of God. All of the lectures and articles are available. Listen at the end of the program for information on how you can order tapes, articles, or a copy of this program.
At the end of our programs in the last several weeks, we have asked you listeners to consider contributing to Christianity at Work financially. In the course of us asking for financial contributions, Jack and I, as you know, have been rather reticent to do this, and a little bit, not because we don't believe in this program, we sincerely and honestly and deeply believe in it. And yet, how do you ask for contributions? I know that, Jack, you have some real concerns about how contributions are often elicited. Can you share that concern with us?
Well, I think I've mentioned in the past that it's so easy, it's so tempting to manipulate people by hyping what we are doing or by somehow appealing to people at an emotional level where we move their emotions. And for people who are like me, many Christians have grown up in an environment where to be moved emotionally is equated with being moved by the Spirit of God. And over the course of time, I think I've just simply come to see that that's just not true. There are many times in my life where I have been moved emotionally and had nothing to do with the Spirit of God. And the more I study the Scriptures about what the Spirit of God does, the Spirit who's called the Spirit of Truth by Jesus in the Gospel of John, we know that the Spirit is moving when things become clear to me, when my mind is enlightened and I begin to understand what's important, what's valuable, what's true, what's relevant. And out of that clarity, I become persuaded to follow God, to serve God, and obey God. That's what it means to be moved by the Spirit of God. So as people approach the question of financial giving, if they're going to ask the question, well, is God moving me to support this program? The question a person should ask is not, have I been emotionally kind of swept into a precipitous decision to write a check to this program, but rather, as they sit back and reflect, the question is the kind of Christianity that is being propounded by this program, the kind of Christianity that I believe in, the values that I believe in, the truth that I believe in, and something, therefore, that I want to support? And is the actual vehicle of that program something that I think is valuable enough that it needs to be supported? If with some kind of clarity and some kind of persuasion, I can answer yes to those questions, and I have an interest, therefore, in being a part of what this program is doing, then that is the movement of the Spirit of God, if I am rightly understanding how the Spirit works, and I think I do. So if you listeners can answer those questions, yes, I like that Christianity going out, yes, that program is doing a good job of doing that, and you want to be a part of it, then I would welcome you to join us in making this possible for your contributions.
And Jack, sometimes when I say that yes, it's an emphatic yes, and that also is an emotional welling up inside of me that as we spoke of before, especially in our, well, in our series in the past, many times we've used the word passion. Does it well up in me a passion for what I want here? And if it does, then I can give. So it isn't really apart from emotion, but the emotion comes out of a well-thought-out understanding of what I'm doing.
Yeah, the emotion emerges from clarity of understanding.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, On behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.